RBG has passed away, which means, yes, on the horizon, there will be a brawl that will make Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield seem like a petty sibling fight. Hopefully in this confirmation battle, there will be no ear biting. But quite frankly, who really knows? I guess expect the unexpected. But before we get to that knockdown brawl that we know is coming, let's take a moment to honor and remember the notorious RBG. So in today's podcast, Mackenzie Smith and I talk a lot of RBG. And while you're listening, maybe do a plank in honor of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, and with us today again is Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I am doing today's podcast partly in honor of you. I do know that, obviously, RBG passed away this last week, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I know that since you have talked so glowingly of her, she is a hero of yours, also a hero of mine, and I will explain that here in just a bit. But what were your thoughts when you heard of her passing?
You know, it's... 2020 has been an overwhelming year in so many ways, and it was Friday evening, and I was getting ready to do our family fantasy football draft with
my kids.
We're a little late to the game here, but we're up and running now. And
nice.
My husband was coming home, and he actually told me he had heard, I guess, on the radio in the car. And I just couldn't even process it because I knew I had to be with my kids, and they were
right.
So much looking forward to doing this draft. And I had to spend that time with them because, as you know, the quality time is sometimes
it
hard
is.
To come by. So I was able to kind of compartmentalize it, but my phone, I was getting a lot of texts from people, and you texted me, and, you know, obviously I knew that I was going to have to sit down and process it at some point. So, Sunday morning I did, and I'm devastated. I mean, it's horrible. It's such a huge loss, and she was a personal icon of mine and many other people I know.
I got to tell you, you got me now a little bit flustered because now all I can think about is who did you pick up in the draft? But nonetheless, I got to focus here. Well, no, did you get Mahomes? Who got Mahomes?
No, actually, my stepdaughter has Mahomes.
Okay,
I think
she's going to win the league.
A little
then.
Bit of a crush on him, which I respect her taste. Like, no,
she's
problem
smart.
There.
Yes.
And I'm against her this week, and I have Lamar Jackson, and I think I'm projected at 138, and she's projected at 137.6
wow.
or something. So it's quite a matchup this week, and we'll see what happens. Lamar did not perform for me last week, so
now because yeah, we are. Because people might be listening to this several months from now, not just necessarily this week. Let me just go ahead and state for the record that this week the Chiefs are playing the Baltimore Ravens. And so Mahomes will be facing Lamar Jackson. So your two players here are going to be going head-to-head, even though they're not actually going head-to-head. They're quarterbacks, and they're not going to be playing defense. But nonetheless, I'm going to get back off my squirrel chase and get back onto RBG. She is definitely a cultural icon. I mean, I do this bit called Man on the Street interviews, where I go out there with a camera crew and I interview various people on the street. And I like to ask them if they recognize a Supreme Court justice, and I'll show them all 9 Supreme Court justices, and pretty much, let me just tell you the results. No, they have no idea. They don't even know who the Chief Justice is on the Supreme Court, except for one justice. Pretty much everyone knew who RBG was. She is known by the public, and she's adored. I mean, do you have any idea why RBG is so adored by the general public?
I mean, she was definitely a force. I think she was a tiny lady, and she
yes.
was very powerful. And, I think in her later years, she just kind of became somewhat of an icon for a certain cultural moment. Obviously she knew that, and I think she was pretty amused by it because she certainly never sought it out. She just was who she was. But I think that authenticity really kind of created it for her. Like, she was never trying to be somebody she wasn't, and she had this amazing career at a moment in time when it just spoke to so many people, myself included. I think the Notorious RBG book came out, was first published, I believe, while I was in law school. So that really had a lot to do with, you know, why I started studying her and following her career. And, you know, it's just, she was a moment in time.
Obviously. I want to talk a little bit about her career today, but first let's just, I'm going to play for you some audio of her. This, it was just, she was speaking, this one in front of the University of Buffalo, was doing a bar event where she's speaking. This is, I believe, just 2 years ago. So let me play for you this clip, and then I want to get your response to it. So I got three clips here, but this is the first clip, University of Buffalo.
It was beyond my wildest imagination that I would one day become the Notorious RBG.
All right, so she's there in front of the group, and she said, yeah, she had no idea when she was starting out in her career that she would one day be called the Notorious RBG, but she really welcomed that that idea, didn't she? I mean, she really kind of embraced the nickname Notorious RBG.
She did, and she got such, I heard, I don't know if this is one of the clips you're going to play, but I heard an interview with her at one point where she was comparing herself to the Notorious B.I.G. And she said, you know, it doesn't seem like there that we would have a lot in common, but we both hail from Brooklyn. Like, she thought it was
real.
Hilarious.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, she knew who he was and had learned about him. So she definitely embraced it for sure.
All right. Well, another clip. Let's listen to this other clip.
Viewing the court, there was something wrong with the picture. The public would see these eight rather well-fed men coming on the bench.
I'm telling you, the audience loved that response of eight well-fed men, and then she came in into that bench. So she really knew how to liven up a group.
Yeah, she, I think, you know, she knew who she was in terms of being a lawyer and obviously later a judge and a justice. And you can't, when you're in a courtroom trying to command authority, you can't shy away from your physical presence. I mean, I'm a small individual and I'm vertically challenged, and you know, it's something you just kind of have to embrace. And I think she, you know, had a great sense of self-confidence and sense of humor about her physical presence. And it's something that I aspired to in my career. I remember when I first started at the DA's office in my county, and the DA was giving a training series, and I don't think I'm betraying any, you know, secrets or confidences here, but he was training us on how to give opening and closing statements and, you know, the best way to do it and what to say and what not to say. But a part of the training was your physical presentation. And he said that you want to stand about one body length away from the jury box. You don't want to be too up in their faces, and you don't want to be back all the way on the other side of the courtroom. You want to stay one body length away, you know, about all your height. And he said, except for you, Mackenzie, you might want to back up a little further because 5 feet away is too close. And, you know, I thought that was like the greatest thing. I took it as such a compliment, and I was like, no problem.
Okay.
I can handle that. I'll just put on some higher heels. Like, it's fine. So I think, you know, having that sense of self-assuredness really gets you pretty far when you're on the slighter side in terms of physical presence.
Yes. You know, I like to track humor. It's kind of what I do in my calling. And during my class, I like to play from my class clips of when there was jokes at the Supreme Court. And I've been told, and I found out through my study, that RBG was one of the funnier justices. Now, lately, because of her age and frailty, you haven't really seen it. But when she is allowed to just sit down and talk to a crowd, she was hilarious. Let's listen to this next clip where she is going to drop a sex joke here in front of the audience, and the audience is going to love it.
Why I stopped using sex and started using gender. It was a secretary I had at Columbia Law School who said, I'm typing these briefs and these speeches for you, and the word sex juts out all over. She said, don't you know that the audience you are addressing, their first association of the word sex is not what you want them to be thinking about.
And so she got a great response from her audience. Yeah, she and in that particular clip there, she was actually addressing the issue of why do you use gender and not sex? What was your rationale for it? And apparently it's because she didn't want the person reading the brief and seeing the word sex umpteen different times to be thinking of the wrong thing. So she changed it from sex to gender. But yeah, she definitely knew how to warm up a crowd and get a lot of laughs. Apparently she is one of the funnier justices on the Supreme Court. Also, she has been the subject of many movies right now. Have you seen her movies? We have On the Basis of Sex. Did we even talk about that movie?
I don't think we have, but I did watch it. I actually watched it when I was about 8.5 months pregnant last year with my son.
Okay.
And I had a business trip and, you know, I had to fly out to California and, you know, cross country travel when you're 8.5 months pregnant is like less than comfortable. And I just, when I got in, I just had to like kind of take my mind off the case and relax for a couple hours. So I ordered some room service and watched that movie. And I had like a huge oral argument the next day that I was really nervous about. And, you know, watching that movie was so inspirational to me. I was like, okay, I can do this. And especially, you know, knowing RBG and her, all the advocacy work she did for, you know, rights of pregnant women and mothers. And it's just, you know, having that kind of as the foundation to this argument. And, you know, spoiler alert, I lost.
I wasn't going to ask.
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, it happens. I mean, what are you going to do? That's litigation, right? But just having that inspiration, I held my head high and I knew I did the best I could. And it was just a great way to like kind of go into that that week of work. Yeah, so.
It was an amazing story on the basis of sex. And I really liked it from a litigator's standpoint because when I was worked for my previous firm, we were involved in constitutional litigation. And we're always trying to, you know, figure out how can we use litigation, you know, the lawsuit to change culture and towards a certain direction. And that's what she did. I mean, she saw I don't want to give any spoiler alerts for that movie for those who have not seen it yet. But when she was a litigator, she wanted to establish this precedent that would prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. That's how you get the title of the movie, On the Basis of Sex. Well, she knew that you just can't take a case and one case and win it all in one swell swoop. You got to chink away at that armor. And so in the case that she picked up on was a tax case where she defended a guy who was denied a tax exemption because the guy was not a girl. Apparently, the law in that particular time was that you could claim a deduction for, caring for your elderly parents if you are a female, but you cannot claim expenses for caring for your elderly parent if you are a male. She said that was discrimination on the basis of sex. So I found it interesting that she advanced her cause forward by bringing a lawsuit on behalf of discrimination against a guy and not a girl. Any thoughts on that case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that case was in 1972. And it doesn't seem that long ago when you think about it, that these things were just fundamental assumptions in the law. Like I think back then, like many women could not sign a mortgage on their own. If they were single, they had to have their father co-sign, could not take out a credit card in their own name, could not serve on juries in many states. And likewise, men, I think she litigated a case at some point where men in this particular jurisdiction, the drinking age was older than it was for women because women were assumed to be more responsible than men. Or like the case you just mentioned, the 1972 case, could not get a caregiver deduction on their tax return. Like it wasn't, she was so smart and so savvy to know that, you know, we're not going to stage a revolution and change hearts and minds by just having this sweeping, you know, change overnight. That's not how people's hearts and minds work. What you have to do is play the slow game and show people that, you know, allow them, give them the tools, I guess, to come to the correct conclusion on their own, as opposed to trying to control, you know, what they think and what they believe. Yeah. And she really started doing that so early in her career, you know, in the 70s when she was at the ACLU. And of course, you know, later when she was appointed to the bench, I think, you know, a lot of people just think of her and they don't know these stories. And they're like, oh, you know, feminist, women's rights. And it wasn't really women's rights. It was equal rights. And in fact, her last case as an attorney before the Supreme Court, I think in the late 70s, was a case that dealt with whether jury duty for women should be optional. And at that point in time, I guess in some states, you know, if you were subpoenaed for jury duty and you were a man, you had to go. And if you got a subpoena and you were a woman, you could like choose to go or you could decide not to.
Right.
And she argued that that was, you know, not okay and unconstitutional, and said that participation in jury duty was, you know, vital governmental service and civic duty, and it should not be optional for men or women. And I believe at oral argument before the court, Justice Rehnquist literally asked her, okay, so you're saying you won't settle for Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar? Like, you have to have like full rights. And she did not answer the question, I think, smartly, and sat down and rested on her brief. But, you know, she wasn't this revolutionary in the like common parlance of the word. She wasn't, you know, taking to the streets and demanding sweeping overthrows. She did it in a much more nuanced, slow roll type of way. But
yeah, chinked away at the armor.
That's right. And in that way, hearts and minds actually do change. It just takes a couple of generations. So you got to be patient, but she was, and she saw a lot of it in her lifetime.
Interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting peer view into how the court system works. It's like if she had brought a case, let's just say equal pay for women, this is before the Civil Rights Act, let's say, in front of the Supreme Court justices, all guys, they very well might say, no, I think that there are valid bases for distinguishing men between and women. We're not willing to go there. But she didn't start off that way. She started off with wait a second, why is this guy who's trying to get a tax exemption for caring for his elderly parent, why is he denied the exemption when a lady would be given that exemption? That is discrimination on the basis of sex. These all male lawyers said, all right, I get that. That does make sense. And so we're going to say that discriminating on the basis of sex is unconstitutional. And so it worked out in her. And that she was just setting the precedent, cheeking away at the armor to get what she really wanted to get. So let's just jump right into her role as a Supreme Court justice. Any particular opinions that you you remember fondly or are your favorites from her?
I focus mostly on her dissents because I think that's where, like her BFF Scalia, that's where her writing and, you know, when she read them from the bench, her speeches really shined. And like some of her
Let's pause right there for a second, because there's a reason why some of her best work or most of her best work was in dissent. And that's because in her 27 years on the bench, she really was never in majority. It was always pretty much a 5-4 conservative court on most issues. And here's how the Supreme Court works. Whenever there's a decision, 5-4 or whatever, 6-3, you give the numbers. The question is, who writes the opinion? Well, here's who decides it. The justice who has the most seniority in the majority gets to assign that opinion. And so if it's the Chief Justice, the Chief Justice is always going to have seniority over everyone else. All right, so if she is in dissent on most of these cases, then she's never going to write the majority opinion. If she is in the majority, but the chief is also in the majority because he casts the deciding vote, most likely he's not going to assign the opinion to her. He would assign the opinion to maybe himself to write it a little bit more narrowly. So she very rarely would have gotten the option or the ability to write a controversial landmark decision, because more often than not, she was in dissent. And if she wasn't in dissent, then that meant Kennedy would have been in the majority, and Kennedy would have written that opinion. So there's a good reason for that, why most of her best work was in dissent.
Right. And in her dissenting opinions, they're her words, right? Like in a majority opinion, you don't know,
right,
you know, what iterations the opinion had to go through, because there is a lot of posturing and jockeying. Like, you know, most people probably don't appreciate,
yes,
that when the justices set out to write an opinion in a case, like, there's so many edits and revisions that go through. And sometimes, you know, a justice,
right,
will say, well, I'm not going to sign on to this opinion if you keep that in, but if you take this out and put this in, then I'll sign,
right,
on, or I'm only going to concur to this part and not that part. So it really, I mean, it is one justice usually who writes the majority opinion, but it's really the work of so many different iterations, and there are a lot of, you know, cooks in the broth.
Right, right, because whoever's writing that majority opinion has to write it in such a way that five or four other justices will sign on to it. So they're very conscientious about what they put in there, because they know that I always got to keep Breyer on this opinion. If I write it too far to the right, I lose Breyer, so I can't do that. So, they're always thinking about writing it to appease the other justices, but not if they're writing a dissent. Because,
right,
in dissent, who cares who else joins? If they don't join, I don't care. I'm still say, get my 2 cents in.
Yeah, and I think there are so many that you can point to, and she was brilliant in so many. But I guess my personal favorite, I mean, I have so many. Top three, it's even hard for me to pick top three. But the Lilly Ledbetter case, which is a 2007 case, and it's, you know, I think,
okay,
pretty famous case, Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire. And it had to do with equal pay for women, actually. And specifically,
yes,
the statute of limitations applicable to claims of pay discrimination. And when,
okay,
you know, I guess I'm going to mess up the facts of this case, but essentially there was a woman who worked for Goodyear for many, many years. And I think either upon retirement or after retirement discovered that she was being paid less than the men who did the exact same job with the exact same credentials, and filed a claim, but the claim was ruled out of time or untimely because, you know, there was a specific statute of limitations, so it could only go back,
yeah,
you know, you can only get your back wages for the last 2 years, not the last 20 years.
Right.
But she had just discovered it. She never knew it before. And the majority opinion was written by Justice Alito and, you know, upheld the, I guess, administrative judge's decision ultimately, and said that,
right,
you know, that statute of limitations was applicable and you could only go back the 2 years. And RBG dissented. And, you know, it's just interesting because she had been in, like, quote unquote, the real workforce before becoming a lawyer.
Right.
She graduated,
right,
from Cornell undergrad and got married, like, I think a month after she graduated, but she was at the very top of her class. But her husband, Marty, was called up for active duty in the Army. And so she moved to Oklahoma with him and applied to work at the Social Security Administration. And she,
okay,
was actually, she got a job, but was demoted to a typist, which was a position like far below her education and qualifications, after she became pregnant. And it was openly because of her pregnancy. Like they just said, oh, you're pregnant, you get demoted, like to grades,
right,
or whatever. So her response to that, of course, was to enroll in Harvard Law School with a one-year-old the following year.
Okay.
Give everyone the middle finger and say, this is what I'm going to do. After she ultimately graduated from Columbia, number one in her law school class, was openly rejected for a Supreme Court clerkship by Justice Frankfurter because she was a woman and he did not want women in his chamber. So she's gone out there and been discriminated against and seen this in the real,
right,
world. And she basically said to Alito, in her opinion, well, I'll read the quote is, in my view, the court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be victims of pay discrimination. So that's like Supreme Court talk for, Alito, you ain't never had a real job. LOL.
You ain't never had a real job. That's right.
And basically, like, calls him out for being totally right. ignorant to, like, what, you know, real people are going through in the workforce. And, like, how could you ever, like, it, when you have a government right. job, your salary is published. Everyone knows what everyone makes. But you're, when you're in the private sector, like, you know what the person next to you makes. Like, you have no idea.
You don't talk about it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not even a polite thing to discuss. Oh, how much are you making? Yeah, you don't talk about that. And that's not how the real world works. And I also find it interesting because that was the mindset. I remember I'm old enough now that I don't know how if you ever had this happen to you, Mackenzie, but I am old enough to remember that our employers even prohibited us from sharing with other employees how much money we made. And so I always kind of thought, well, okay, you don't talk about how much money you made. And then I realized when I was preparing for a CLE recently that, no, it's actually a violation of federal law. You can't prohibit that. You have to allow people to discuss how much they make, or else how would you know you have a claim for unequal pay? But nonetheless, Ginsburg knew how to trash talk, apparently Supreme Court style, which she did again. Now, this might be on your top three list. Is Bush v. Gore in your top three list?
So it's definitely in the top four. It's on my list.
Okay.
It's on a short list.
All right. Because that one is trash talking. I'll go ahead and say that one. This is Bush v. Gore. And so in that case, obviously involved the election of 2000. And normally it is the practice to just dissent or do the majority opinion. You don't actually read your dissent from the bench. But she decided to read her dissent from the bench there in court the day the decision was being rendered. It's also the custom that you conclude your dissent by saying I respectfully dissent. And as we're going to talk a little bit later, I know we're going to get there. She definitely knew how to be respectful. She knew how to disagree in a very respectful way. But apparently she must have also had a mean streak about her, because in this particular opinion, she took out the word respectfully and just said I dissent. And that omission of the middle word might have been akin to giving the middle finger. I'm not sure on that, but nonetheless, that is one of my favorite dissenting opinions, because, again, you have to know a little bit about the Supreme Court to catch that dig, and she definitely was dishing it out.
Well, Bush v. Gore is so interesting, too. I mean, that's like a whole, you could teach an entire class on Bush v. Gore, but, like, just as a lot of people, I think, might be kind of surprised to learn that RBG was an advocate for, you know, quote unquote, men's rights when she was at the ACLU.
Right.
People might be surprised that in Bush v. Gore, she came out very forcefully in favor of states' rights, and not just any state, Florida. You know, I mean, this is not what people think of. Oh, yeah, RBG is a very famous supporter of Florida's right to determine its own elections. It's like,
I know.
Yeah, I
have a hard time with that. All nine justices, I think, were swapping clothes to render that decision. That was an interesting time. And I actually was involved in that whole genre of cases. I had just moved to Florida. Well, that year, in fact, I believe it was October of that year, and you had a November election. And so there are all kinds of lawsuits down there. And I worked for a constitutional firm, so we were involved in those kind of lawsuits, you know, absentee ballots, whether or not they were counted or not counted. Then, of course, you have your hanging chads, you had federal cases, state cases. It was a fascinating time to be a lawyer and just to see how those things were coming down.
I bet it was.
All right.
I remember my grandmother lived in Palm Beach County and was
okay.
horrified with the thought that she might have accidentally voted for Al Gore. So I remember it very well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of one of the jokes I think I heard where it said my dad voted for the Democratic Party this year. And he said, that is just outrageous. He never would have done that when he was alive. But nonetheless, you know, hey, you vote once, you vote early, you vote often. We'll talk about that whole area of lawsuits maybe another day. All right, what's one of your other favorite dissents?
I don't know if these are like funny, but she dissented in Gonzalez versus Carhart, which was another 2007 case. That case yes. dealt with a federal statute, which is called the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act
right.
of 2003. And, you know, the title of legislation is often, you know, inflammatory. It's like the Patriot Act, like, okay, and patriotically we're right. going to spy on everyone. But it basically what the statute did, or at least the portion that was at issue in this case, it banned a certain procedure, like a certain way of performing what we refer to as late term abortions, which are typically second trimester, but whatever, we'll call them late term abortions.
Okay.
And it was this federal law, so it applied in every state, and it even applied when the procedure that was at issue was necessary to avoid endangering the woman's health. So there was no exception, like, you know, you can't do this except for when it might, you know, be necessary for a woman's health. So mostly we're talking about situations in which continuing a pregnancy would endanger a woman. But anyway, the majority upheld the statute, and RBG, who, again, people might be surprised to learn, was actually a critic of Roe v. Wade when that
she
was a critic of it. And, you know, it goes back to what we were just talking about. She saw it as too much of a sweeping ruling that, you know, impacted what should have been subject to the democratic process. And she thought, you know, the country wasn't really there yet to have this sweeping ruling, like, apply to everyone. And we should have kind of, like, chipped away over time, or had just, you know, I mean, it's a very sensitive issue on which reasonable minds can differ. So maybe, you know, start with, like, small incremental changes and then see how people feel about that and go from there. So she had been a critic, but in this case, she dissented, and she said that, you know, the majority ruling tolerates, indeed applauds, federal intervention to ban nationwide a procedure found necessary and proper in certain cases by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The court deprives women of the right to make an autonomous choice, even at the expense of their safety. This way of thinking reflects ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long since been discredited. And I think, you know, that quote right there shows how firmly her beliefs were held, where even though she had been a critic of Roe versus Wade, she, you know, more than any feeling about abortion per se, this to her was an issue about women's place in society and women's right under the Constitution to have bodily autonomy and be in control of their own medical decisions, especially when, you know, the facts kind of backed it up. So I really think that she did a big service to women everywhere by her dissent in that decision. So it's on my shirt list as well.
Right. Now, obviously, I disagree with her when it comes to her position on abortion. But that being said, her use of dissent is she's thinking of, okay, if I'm going to write in dissent, so we're going to lose this case, but I need to make sure I have something that's extremely important to me. I want to make sure it gets out there and maybe can be used by lower judges later on in some harder, you know, in between middle of the road kind of cases. So she'll put some nuggets there in dissent that lower judges can then use. So I heard that she was attributed with this label of she was always an advocate. And yeah, you see that even Supreme Court justices, they are advocates sometimes for their particular jurisprudence, their way of viewing the Constitution and the law. So even in dissent, that's what she was doing. And also, I know we're going to catch on, we're going to cover a little bit later on what I think, from my personal opinion, is the greatest reason why I like RBG. And that is how she went about disagreeing. But before we get there, do you have any other dissenting opinions you want to talk about?
Yeah, so my last one is her dissent in Shelby County versus Holder, and that case is from 2014, and it has to do with federal...
Another highly controversial case.
Highly controversial case has to do with voting rights, with the voting rights case. And essentially, the backstory is, there's a bunch of states in the South that had Jim Crow laws and didn't let people vote fairly. This is my interpretation. You can agree or disagree.
Right. You're going fair so far.
Yeah. And when those laws got invalidated, there were laws that basically made those states get what's referred to as pre-clearance before enacting any further changes to their voting laws. So, like, if they wanted to pass an ID law, they had to get pre-clearance from the federal government.
With the rationale... the rationale behind that was because you had a history of these Jim Crow laws, they didn't want to then tell the people in these states that had a problem with discriminatory voting practices that were blatant. Okay, you tried to blatantly discriminate in the past. We're not going to let you even do it in a legal way now, where you can hide your discrimination with a supposed valid, you know, voting restriction. Like, hey, you got to show ID, knowing that that would have a disparate impact on a certain racial group. So because of that, if these states that had discriminatory practice, or, you know, passed when it comes to voting rights or voting practices, if you fit within one of those criteria based upon past discrimination, you have to seek pre-clearance of any change to your voting laws. That was the rationale behind these pre-clearance statutes. I'm not saying I'm in favor of them or opposed to them, but that was the rationale for why you had pre-clearance.
Right. So Shelby County, I believe Alabama, wanted to kind of do away with the pre-clearance, and their rationale was, hey, like, this is working. Look, everyone, like, it's been fine. We haven't had any problems. Like, let's just not have to do this anymore. And the majority agreed and said, like, you know, everything seems to be working just great.
Right.
And in dissent, RVG said, throwing out pre-clearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. And I think that is just...
That's good.
It's so vivid and it's such great writing. And, you know, I just think it really... kind of evokes what her feeling on this issue was. And it's hard not to respect it, even if you don't agree.
I would be remiss if I didn't point out, though, something that you just said that applies to what's going on in the news this week, which is... Yeah, she was basically making an anti-states rights argument there. She was saying, hey, look, you know, we don't care that you are your own state and you have your own voting laws. We, as the federal government, you got to pre-clear any change to your voting laws through the federal government. That sounds like an anti-states argument. But I remember you just told me in Bush v. Gore, she made the exact opposite argument, saying, hey, look, in Bush v. Gore, we can't step on the state's toes when they try to do their election laws. It seems like even the Supreme Court justices are not beyond using an argument, using a line to get to their desired result. Now, I mention that because we're going to get to here in just a bit this whole idea of should her replacement be picked by this administration, because we are in an election year. Heck, you could almost say we're in an election month. Should you let the next administration pick her replacement? And some people made some positions 4 years ago that they seem to be making the exact opposite today. And so it apparently that is a standard practice up there in D.C. All right, well, I do want to mention one majority opinion. So it wasn't just in dissent where she did her best work, though I did explain why that is more likely the case. More likely than not, she was in dissent. If she was not in dissent, that meant that Kennedy was probably in on her side, and Kennedy would have then taken the opinion to himself to write. So she would not have gotten, like, you know, the Obergefell decision or any of those kind of cases. But nonetheless, VMI, the Virginia Military Institute case. Are you familiar with that case?
I am familiar with the VMI case, and I think this was, like, early in her tenure on the court, right?
I believe so.
Like in the mid-90s.
Right.
Basically, this case had to do with the Virginia Military Institute, which was a public university or institution of higher education in Virginia. And at the time, it had a male-only admission policy.
Right.
And I believe this case was a 7-1 decision. So it was not, like, you know, even a close case. But
right.
RBG wrote the majority opinion, and they struck down the admission policy under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. And, you know, she said, women seeking and fit for a VMI quality education cannot be offered anything less under the state's obligation to afford them genuinely equal protection. And that's just emblematic of, you know, her iconic status as a fighter and defender of equal protection of the laws.
Now, right there, I got to say, that was a nice outcome, because it'd probably be fair to say that is her crowning achievement. She spent her entire non-judicial career fighting for equal rights for women. And then as a justice, or as a judge and a justice, she was definitely fighting for equal rights. And so here you got a case where that was the central issue in this case. And so I'm just going to assume, and I'll fact check this later on, maybe delete this if I am wrong, but I'm going to assume the chief justice that would have been Rehnquist at that time was in the majority, and he assigned this opinion to her, which, again, a very nice gesture and move for him to do, because this was her main, you know, mission in life, if you will, to fight for equal rights. So to be able to write that opinion, that's just a good ending or crown jewel for her judicial career. Any thoughts on her writing that opinion in particular?
Well, maybe he felt bad about the Susan B. Anthony comment from 17 years prior, and it was just like closing the loop on that one. Maybe by 1996, he had kind of come around, right, like, oh my God, maybe that was a little ignorant. I should probably, you know, step back and let her have at it at this one. So he did the right thing.
I mean, he could have had O'Connor write that opinion, because O'Connor didn't leave the bench until 2000, so she would have definitely been on the bench at that point in time, but nonetheless had RBG, and again, that is, I think, a nice gesture to do. Well, let's talk about her replacement. I know a lot of names have been thrown out there, and I do know that you and I are risking our good name here, because this podcast will be listened
what
to.
What name?
Hey, you know what? good point. But, you know, this podcast will be listened to after this is all said and done, and so we're going to put our neck out there. Who do you think will be the replacement? Well, first of all, do you think that this administration should be picking the replacement? What side of the fence do you fall on? And is it possible for one to answer that question without having their personal preference collar that opinion?
There's like not a word, it was like a one word in the English language that like encapsulates all of the,
right,
you know, feelings that I have about this. It's obviously, you know, such a charged moment. And, you know, what I'm about to say, like, I don't like the fact that these words are going to come out of my mouth, and you might be a little bit shocked. I don't like it. It's uncomfortable for me, but I have to say, like, I don't think that Trump, this is hard for me to get out, I don't think that Trump is doing anything wrong by nominating a justice right now. Now, listen, it is indisputably like his constitutional authority and duty to nominate a replacement for a Supreme Court justice when there is a vacancy.
All right.
And what bothers me about this is face of evil Mitch McConnell,
right,
and his lackeys, Lindsey Graham and Chuck Grassley, who like literally made up a rule,
right,
out of thin air 4 years ago and said like, oh my gosh, hold this against us. Like, you should never even hold a vote on a nominee in an election year because it's anti-democratic. The president no longer has a mandate from a majority, and we've got to wait until after the election. And it's like, yo, this president is president. He never had a mandate by a majority of the American people. No, and listen, I'm okay with the Electoral College like being, I mean, I don't know if I'm okay with it. I acknowledge that that is the way we use it.
That's a whole other subject from Kansas. You got to love the Electoral College. It's getting a bad rap. It is getting a bad rap lately. But nonetheless, I agree with you. Go on.
Yeah. So, you know, I just now to have these same senators come out and say, you know, oh, we only meant that rule applies like if there was two different like parties,
right,
one in control of the presidency and one in control of the Senate. Now that it's the same party, we're going to do what the heck we want. To me, like, first of all, they're lying to the American people when they say it was unprecedented in 2016. I looked it up. It has happened before. The most recent time had been 1881. So it has been more than a century, but like to call it unprecedented was a lie, and they're liars. And they're also hypocrites, which I don't know, maybe their fingers were crossed when they said it in 2016. Like, I don't know if they even, like, would know what a scruple was, like, if it hit them in the face. But, like, my problem isn't, you know, I mean, you can't say, like, Trump should do this, Trump should do that. Like, he's done a lot like, I can take serious issue with. But this... you know, any president would nominate a successor. Like, why would he not? That's part of his job.
Yeah.
And why would he not nominate the person that he most wants, as long as it's a qualified nominee? But, like, you can't really have a problem with what he's doing. What the problem is, as it always seems to come down to these days, is that Congress is broken and can't do its job and is filled with hypocrites, and it's very distressing to watch.
Mackenzie, you said so much there. I don't even know where to start because I am still floored that you actually think that Trump did the right thing by we assume he's going to do the right thing in announcing the replacement here, and I assume there's going to be a vote.
I'm washing my mouth out with Lysol right now that those words even came out of my mouth.
I can imagine. But yes, there's so many different ways to take that. Here's one of the ways I'm going to take that. I am scared of the precedent that is being set. Now, I'm not talking about the precedent of politicians lying. We accept that, right? Politicians just lie. They open up their mouth and words come out. I don't believe them. You don't believe them. What they really are saying is, look, we got the power, so stop us, right? That's what they're really saying. 4 years ago, what Mitch McConnell should have said was, look, we're not the same party as the president. We don't have to confirm. We're not going to. And so we're not even going to hold a vote. It's within the last year. Guess what? We have the power. We're not going to do it. And you know what? That would have been more honest if he had just come right out and said, we have the power. Right now, I am sure what they're saying is, look, we have the power. President is a Republican. The Senate is Republican-controlled. We can appoint, we can confirm, all within, you know, the time that we have left. So guess what? That's what we're going to do. But, Mackenzie, this is why it scares me. This is setting a real dangerous precedent. Because here's what's going to happen the next time. You mark my words, this podcast is going to be recorded. It is being recorded. It's going to be published. So it'll be out there. It'll be 2 years out, and the president will be a Republican. The Congress will be a Democrat, or the Senate will be controlled by the Democrats. It'll be 2 years out, and the Democratic Senate will say, you know what? We're 2 years away from the election. We're going to sit on this for 2 years, right? You know what's going to happen. And then the next time around, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and a Republican Senate, and it'll be 3 years out. And you know what they're going to say? You know what? We have another 3 years till the election. Let's just hold off and wait. The Supreme Court can just continue going on with just three justices. Pretty soon, they're never going to appoint another justice. They're always going to wait until the next election. Is that a doomsday prediction? Do you think that once we've gone down this road, there's no stopping us?
Well, I mean, yeah, I kind of see the more likely scenario being, you know, a justice gets confirmed within the next 40 days. And if, you know, Biden wins the presidency and the Democrats retake control of the Senate, which is not, you know, which is a plausible scenario, then they try to pack the court. And then,
they can't,
you know,
do that.
The next Republican administration packs the court with consent.
They can't pack the court.
I agree.
That would be disastrous. So for your listeners, the last time the court was packed was before 1879. Since the Judiciary Act of 1879, it set it at 9. It's been 9 ever since. I agree with you. That is the thought. Is one side going to pack the court? In other words, hey, you know what? You right now, it's going to be a 5-4, 6-3 conservative majority. You pick the issue. We're going to now raise the number of justices to 15, which I believe it has been 15 before, by the way. We're going to raise them to 15. Well, then the next time the Republicans are in control, they're going to raise it to 21. I mean, where will the madness stop?
Yeah, and I've heard some really interesting proposals from people about how to reform the Supreme Court. And I think, you know, it's true that we can see the prospect of the pendulum kind of swinging wildly out of control. And, you know, I don't think any reasonable person wants that to happen or thinks that it's good for the country. What I kind of, the hope that I'm sort of clinging on to right now is that, you know, we kind of stop in our tracks and ask ourselves, like, has the Supreme Court become too powerful, at least on issues of, you know, social policy? And if so, why is that? And I think, you know, a lot of these issues, when we talk about the Supreme Court and famous rulings or things that have happened in the past in our lifetimes, like notable rulings that the average person would know about, we talk about things like gay marriage and Roe versus Wade and these kind of social policy decisions that, you know, while certainly the Supreme Court has the constitutional authority to address them, they are more easily, they should be more easily addressed in the Congress and more subject to incremental change in the Congress. And it's so easy to, well, should be so easy to legislate, you know, in stages and repeal, you know, sections that don't work anymore and amend legislation. And, you know, there's no reason why 9 unelected justices who have lifetime tenure need to be deciding these issues that are so, you know, controversial and so inflammatory. I mean, I hope gay marriage isn't controversial anymore, but so inflammatory.
Well, it was at the time, though. It was at the time.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, we really need to think, like, is this working for our democracy anymore? And, you know, are there ways to maybe amend the Constitution that everyone would be able to agree on?
Right.
For example, like I've heard someone propose, you know, maybe we have a 20-member or 25-member Supreme Court, but when you have a case that, you know, goes to the Supreme Court, it is decided by a random panel of judges, and you don't know which judges you're going to get until the case is already there. Or, you know, maybe we limit it to 18-year term. Or, you know, there are so many other proposals that I think, I don't know the answer to this, but I think if you ask the majority of Americans, like, should Supreme Court justices have lifetime tenure subject only to retirement or impeachment, most of them would probably say no. They'd probably say, you know, there should be some kind of either mandatory retirement or a term limit.
But here's the problem.
The fact that we're talking about that is a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, but as you point out, the problem is that the justices do not stay in their lane. They way too often get out of hey, we're just going to resolve disputed issues, and they actually create laws and they create rights. And for you to deny that, you would be an idiot. Of course, the Supreme Court creates rights and it creates laws. They've been doing it for the last 50, 70 years, and that's why these confirmation proceedings are so contentious, because the average American recognizes that the court creates rights, and it bothers the average American. We can't vote this person in, and we can't vote them out. And here's the only real way you can combat that. Justices, stay in your lane. And I really think that is what the message Roberts is going to give the other 8 justices. Hey, look, we got some controversial opinions coming up. We've got to stay in our lane. And if we're too disruptive, if we overthrow, you know, established super precedents, whatever that super precedents might be, there's going to be a revolt. People are going to be demanding to pack the court. It's just not a good look for the court unless they stay in their lane. So I think you're going to see a very reticent, nervous Supreme Court over the next 4 years as they address these issues. But hey, let's touch base here on who. Well, do you have a thought on who will be the replacement? I mean, I know several people have been mentioned. Do you want to guess or just leave it to hey, this upcoming week? We're going to find out tomorrow. My guess is Amy Coney Barrett. She is a 7th Circuit judge. The reason why I mention her is she has been, her name has been thrown out there for now a couple of years. So she's been well vetted. If there's anything in her closet, it would have come out by now, right? All these other ones are somewhat new to the scene. And there's a lot of a risk here, because if they mess up on this one, they probably don't have time to do a second one, and they got to get it right the first shot. That's why I'm going with Amy Coney Barrett, though I've heard the name Barbara Lagoa mentions by several sources. I'm just wondering if she's been fully vetted at this point. Would they feel confident in appointing someone they haven't had the time to fully vet? Any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I agree with you. I think it'll probably be Amy Coney Barrett. I think she was on the very, very short list when Kavanaugh was nominated. And, you know, I mean, I wish, well, whatever. I think it will be, I think it will be her. I think you're right that she's been vetted. And there's really no dispute that she is qualified. And I think if you go back to Susan Collins' speech on the floor of the Senate, when Kavanaugh was confirmed, Susan Collins actually set out a legal or a constitutional standard for what advice and consent means in her opinion. And obviously, as we all know, she's going to be one of the senators that people are looking to, you know, in terms of like, is she going to vote to confirm this person? And, you know, under the Collins standard, as I'll call it, you know, Amy Barrett is going to get confirmed, like no doubt. I mean, she has the bona fides, she has the credentials, she's obviously highly intelligent. She would not be my nominee. She is way too far right for my liking. But, you know, I can't sit here and say that she is not qualified or intelligent enough to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, she certainly is. So it's a very, under the Collins standard, it's a very difficult nominee to argue with. And if there's going to be a floor vote, you know, at least under that standard, she's going to easily get confirmed.
And I'm just going to throw it out there, but I know a lot of women who are conservatives and they don't have any representation on the court. There are no conservative females on the court. There are three that tend to go liberal. Two of them have historically consistently gone liberal. The third one is more liberal than not, but still there are no female conservatives on the court. But there are, so I know a lot of women who've expressed that disagreement, my wife being the number one person, but nonetheless, like how come we don't have a conservative female on the court when a lot of us hold these views, and it seems misrepresentation to have 100% of the female voice on the court being liberal. Why can't we have a female conservative voice on the court? You know what? I'm going to just throw this out there. I think RBG would be happy that the women's movement has advanced to that point where, yes, even a conservative a female voice is welcomed on the high court. Any thoughts on that?
I actually agree with you there. And it reminds me of RBG's famous quote when someone asked her, like, in your view, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court? And she said, when there are nine.
Yes.
And, you know, some men that I know have reacted to that and said, like, ew, why would you need nine? And it's like, guys, look at literally all of history. Like, are you joking me? Like, you don't see the world through our eyes. Like, it is the default to have it, or it has been the default for most of history to have it be all men. And it doesn't offend me as a human being, but like, why shouldn't, I think what she was saying there is like, why shouldn't it? The default is to have the nine best legal minds in the country, regardless of sex or creed or race or any other status. So I think that I agree with you there. And, you know, I definitely think, you know, she's probably up there with Marty thinking, well, you know, it's better than another well-fed man.
Right. Hey, we're getting close. We're not quite to nine yet, but we're getting close. Well, obviously, I kind of saved for last my favorite thing about RBG. Well, I like her workout regime. So if you're looking for a new workout regime, Google RBG's workout regime. You'll see a video of her doing planks and push-ups every single day. Maybe we should do the RBG workout for the next month. I don't know. It's actually not a bad idea. But that's not the reason. That's not my favorite thing about her. My favorite thing is her relationship with Scalia, because Scalia is one of my favorite justices. I kind of identify with him, you know, when it comes to his jurisprudence, both from being an originalist and also Scalia was a liberal when it came to the Fourth Amendment. But I like the fact that RBG and Scalia had a real close friendship. And of course, I know right now that's well known. Everyone's talking about it. But man, does our world ever need that as a reminder right now that we can disagree and still do it in a very civil way.
It's so true. I think, you know, she really embodied that. And it, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, I also actually loved Scalia, more on just like a personal level. And I remember, you know, my father and I talk about politics a lot. And several years before Scalia passed away, I had bought my dad a copy of Scalia Dissents.
Okay.
Book that was just basically, you know, his dissent.
Right.
So I'd read a lot about,
you
about
bought that.
Him just because my, I did, I bought it. Just because, you know, I thought it would be an interesting thing for my dad and I to read, you know, separately, right. and talk about, and studying their relationship. It really, you know, it was that, that is an example that I think we should all aspire to. And it's just so poignant at this moment in what's going on in our country. And we really need to ask ourselves, like, do I just want to cut off 40% of the country and not ever talk to
right.
anybody, you know, who thinks differently than I do again? Or is there, do I have to, you know, strip this down to the fundamentals and think like, okay, these are my fellow countrymen. And clearly there are some very deeply held differences, but there's, you know, a few things that we have in common, and let's just kind of revert back. It reminds me, it's very personal for me. My grandmother passed away a year ago, and almost exactly a year ago. And she's the one who I mentioned was aghast that she might've,
right.
you know, accidentally voted for Al Gore. She was a staunch conservative.
Okay.
But she,
I like her already.
Yeah, yeah, you would have loved her, but she passed away at 95, so she was a bit older than Justice Ginsburg, but she lived through most of the same moments in our country's history.
Okay.
And like a year or two before she died, my grandmother said to me, you know, there's only a few things in life that truly matter, but the ones that do matter very much. And I think it's a profound truth, and I think it's something that RBG really embodied as well. And she knew that, like, the politics, the partisan rhetoric, all of that stuff, like, it's the stuff that doesn't matter.
Yes.
Like, what really matters is how we treat each other and the relationships between people within families, communities, and ultimately, like, within our country on the whole. And they were both two women who we've lost, you know, in the past within a year of each other. But for me personally in my life, you know, that's what I carry away from the example they set. I mean, it's,
right.
I learned a lot about how to be a mother from my grandmother. I learned a lot about how to be a lawyer from RBG, but
right.
there's something so much deeper and so much more important. And it's like how to be a human being in this time. And we really need to, like, we need that lesson.
Now there's some crazies out there, cause I've seen them on Facebook and they're friends of mine. Some of them are relatives, but nonetheless, they can't stand RBG, and they don't have anything nice to say about her, and they want to just tear her down. And my response was, look, don't go there. That's just not the proper way to handle differences in America. I don't know who I heard it say recent, who I heard said this recently, but probably Ben Shapiro. And Ben Shapiro said, look, we don't build statues for people for what they did wrong. We build statues for what they did right, what we're trying to celebrate. And I got to tell you, RBG did an awful lot of right and good, even from a conservative's position and standpoint. And the things that we disagree about, well, yeah, you disagree, but that's also a democracy. We learn to disagree and still move forward. And so, yeah, definitely a life worth celebrating. And even though I got to admit, I'm not sure I get her style of music. I know her and Scalia were really big with the opera. You forwarded me this article this last week written by Eric Motley that was published in the New York Times. Now, I'll let you talk a little bit about that article, but one of the things I first noticed was he said that he met RBG and they bonded over Goldberg Variations. I had no idea what that was. And so I think you made fun of me for that. So I then asked my son, and my son also said, well, of course, Dad, who doesn't know what the F. Goldberg Variations are? So now apparently I feel really stupid. But nonetheless, Yeah.
And now that you've heard them, you'll keep coming back for more.
Oh my goodness, that is so bad.
Did you see what I did there? Yeah.
I think it's Friday.
I mean, give me a break.
I think what you've been doing is drinking. I had no idea you were allowed to drink during podcasts, but hopefully you can get an Uber on the way home. But yeah, no, that was actually a really good article. It spoke well to who RBG is.
Yeah, exactly. And this, I would urge everyone to read it. It's an opinion. It's in the opinion section of the New York Times, I believe yesterday. And Eric Motley is the executive vice president of the Aspen Institute. But he's a conservative and he was a close personal friend of RBG. And they did meet at a dinner party discussing the Fox Goldberg variations. But they, you know, they were able to have a long, beautiful, deep friendship over the course of many years. And, you know, even though he was a conservative and she obviously was liberal, they discussed not politics, but the ideas that underlie policy.
Right.
And that's how, you know, it's really difficult when you talk to someone who is informed and who cares about getting facts right and who is thoughtful and, you know, open to listening to different points of view. It's really tough to walk away from a conversation like that, not at least having some shred of respect for the other person. So I think if we can, you know, get back to the ideas that underlie, you know, all of this political wrangling and kind of, you know, stop and try to see the forest for the trees, we can learn, you know, from these lessons, learn how to interact with each other in a more civil way, hopefully. And it's I would urge everyone to read that article. It's short and it's really, I mean, it's really sad because RBG was supposed to marry Mr.
Yes.
Motley and his fiance last Friday, which was the day she died. So she was going to do it in her apartment just as a favor because they couldn't have their big wedding due to the pandemic. So it's really heartbreaking, but it's also uplifting in the way he talks about, you know, their relationship.
Notorious RBG. Hey, there you go. We actually have run out of time for today. We were going to talk about the Breonna Taylor situation, but I guess we'll have to hold off for that until next week. But it does kind of fit in with RBG, as it is, how can we talk about things in America with civility? And of course, she set the example for that as well. So thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining us today. And I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Yep, that's a whole nother podcast. So
I know.
I'll talk to you next week for more.
All right, thanks so much. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.